assume when you're around a mic that it's on. Hey, good evening, truth seekers. Malloy here. I don't know how to get into anything tonight. I just don't. This 630 point drop today and 500 the other day and yada, yada, yada. We are in a world of hurt on the one hand. On the other hand, you kind of have to burn off the underbrush if you want the forest to thrive, right? We are witnessing something here. I hope, deep in my heart, I really do, I mean this, I hope that what we're witnessing is the utter and absolute destruction of casino capitalism or predatory capitalism, however you want to label it. You know, the Dow lost 600 points today. What the hell is the Dow Jones Industrial Averages of 30 stocks? What's it doing at 12,000, 11,000, 15,000? What kind of nonsense is that? Before I tell you the solution, a lot of people say, what's the solution? I put the solution out there so many times, but I keep getting emails from right-wing brain-dead jackasses who say, well, you always complain all the time. What's your solution? Well, there is one. It's so obvious. That's why the right-wingers don't see it. Right-wingers are not interested in solutions. They're interested in destruction. And if we're talking about destroying the same thing, I'm with you, you right-wing jackasses. You think that the destruction is about Obama and his socialism, right? Christ, how can people be this stupid? But anyway, before we get into that, tonight's program, all this week, brought to you by Farm Aid 2011. As you know, since 1985, Willie and Annie Nelson and Farm Aid and everybody have worked to keep family farmers on their land. Because family farmers are where our strength is in this country, really, when you stop and think about it. It's our best resource for good food, good health, strong economy. This year's concert will be this Saturday, August 13th, in Kansas City, Kansas. And if you go to farmaid.org, there's a form there. You can tell your senator it's time to support family farmers and ranchers. Tell them. I don't know. No, who knows? You know, don't laugh. The Senate is not the insane asylum that the House is. It can come pretty close, but it's not. Tell your senators to back off from always supporting these death-dealing factory farms, the ones that make us all sick, and start supporting family farms, family ranchers, okay? Do that for me. Do it for yourself. Do it for everybody. Do it for America. And Bio Willie and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. Are we going to have somebody on about that this week, Kathy? Okay, we're going to have somebody about that. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the week when I can sound like I know what I'm talking about. Might as well start out with Prairie 2. Free market and die. Well, there's a headline for you. This is what Prairie 2 writes. U.S. markets lost $1.5 trillion in these 2 weeks just passed, and pretty much doubled that today. There are rumors that today's plunge was fueled entirely by one big hedge fund that needed to make margin calls. The biggest losses were in the U.S. bank stocks, with Bank of America losing 20% of its value. This may indicate that there are fears about the European banking crisis spreading here. This would be in spite of the European Central Bank's plan to buy as many bonds from Spain and Italy as needed, with several $1 billion spent today. Commodities plunged in price today as well, which the talking heads blamed on the fear of a weak economy after the U.S. having been downgraded. This isn't true, of course. In reality, the commodity markets have been seriously inflated by speculators and hedge funds that now need to meet margin calls. So they sell. ExxonMobil's CEO testified before Congress that 40% of the price of gasoline is caused by this Wall Street speculation. It's funny that the teabaggers aren't worried about that sort of taxation without representation. Of course, their slogan is free market or die, or really free market and die. A steep drop in gasoline prices would be a huge stimulus for the economy. In fact, the economy isn't that bad if the Republicans can be held at bay. We will recover eventually. The recovery will be slow and very painful for the unemployed, however. Absent any government policies being turned back to pre-Reagan standards, that is. So when I say recovery, I mean out of the ditch and into the muddy rut, not into some libertarian paradise with streets of gold. This sort of recovery will, at best, lead to the U.S. being indistinguishable from Mexico. But, of course, this is far better than being indistinguishable from Somalia. The major point made in the S&P downgrade that isn't reported is their decision was in fact based primarily on the Republicans' unwillingness to ever raise revenue, and that Congress has confirmed that with this new law. It doesn't take a mathematical genius to figure out that you can't cut enough from the budget to ever balance the budget, even if you eliminated Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid payments entirely. And taxpayers continued to pay the FICA tax anyway, it still wouldn't be close enough. This doesn't factor in that revenue would also fall sharply as the economy collapsed around us. In fact, we wouldn't be looking into the abyss right now at all, except for the austerity measures already forced through by Republicans. 1 million government jobs have been eliminated already, mostly in red states, which would put the unemployment rate below 8% by itself. This is without all the other jobs lost in the general economy that these jobs in turn supported. As for all the doom and gloom forecast to befall us from the downgrade, it's fallen on deaf ears down at the bond traders. The price of treasuries continues to climb to new highs and thus driving interest rates down. The government can borrow money for 90 days for almost free, and the 10-year bills that are used to determine consumer interest rates have set another new low. Gold did shoot up spectacularly today, going well over $1,700 an ounce, but that's more from people not being willing to sell than from any huge demand. People are mostly going into U.S. dollars and bonds. Now might be a good time to sell gold once the price starts heading for the floor. You won't be able to get rid of it. If you bought it cheap, of course, you have nothing to lose, and it does give a certain peace of mind, like canned goods. PrairieNumeral2.com. I watched some of the cannibalism going on Wall Street today via CNBC and MSNBC and CNN. I also took some time to listen on my Sirius satellite radio as I was going to pick up Molly from school. I listened to Barack Obama say something about the economy. I have no idea what he was talking about. It made no sense. This man is not a leader, and I now join the ranks of those who hope that he'll be a one-term president. Not the ranks of the teabaggers and the right-wing crazy people who want to blow the country into hell. But I'm waiting. Is there anyone out there in the Democratic Party who will challenge him in the primaries? Anyone? In the Sunday Times, there's a piece by Drew Weston, who is a professor here at Emory in Atlanta. And according to one of our partners, John Sinton, we know him. I guess we've met him. Maybe at Sinton's house, I don't know. But he had a piece in the New York Times on Sunday entitled, after they changed it, What Happened to Obama? And during the third hour of the program tonight, I'm going to share the entire thing with you. All right, we'll be back in a minute. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Shade of their skin or the shape. Stay Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Right, the solution to all this, we talked about it before, of course, is the jobs program. It's for every time I hear during the day, passing through one room or another, and I look on television, because we usually have one going somewhere in the house, and I see the president's going to speak in 26 minutes, 22 minutes, 18 minutes, you know. I think, okay, what's it going to be this time? And I do listen because, after all, he is our president. And I always hear pretty much the same thing, the inability to function as a president. And as Drew Weston put forth in his essay on Sunday, it's apparently starting to look like Barack Obama is in way over his head. He just doesn't have the ability, the knowledge, the experience, the understanding to be the president of the United States at any time in our history, but especially not now. Now, I know that Democrats and liberals and yada, yada, yada are just going to get their bloomers in a wad over that statement, but it's nothing new that you're hearing on this program. Anyway, jobs, jobs, jobs. The problem that we're having here has nothing to do with credit ratings from this half-ass outfit, Standard & Poor's, that helped lead us into this mess. It has nothing to do with debt ceilings, this phony-ass structure that exists so that it can be used politically at some point. It has nothing to do with national debt or budget deficits or anything. It has to do with the fact that Americans are not working. And if Americans are not working, we're not earning paychecks. And blah, blah, blah. If we're not earning paychecks, we're not spending. If we're not spending, products are not flying off the shelves, which means that more products have to be made. Of course, so many of them are made someplace else, but that brings up a whole different paradigm of how to staunch the flow of dollars going out and garbage, crap, poison from China coming in that we seem to be addicted to. Two different streams there. Eventually, they do connect. But the quickest way, in my opinion, and Chris Matthews was talking about this. Now, I have to be honest with you. I don't know if he came up with this idea first or if I did. It seems to me that I came up with this idea some time ago. Maybe not. Maybe it's just a trick that my mind is playing on me. But to keep it very simple, the President of the United States, while this filthy Congress is out on its, whatever the hell it's doing, on its August break, President of the United States ought to sit down with some real advisors. Just pay him by the hour, for Christ's sake. I'm sure Stiglitz and Krugman would love to come in and consult with Mr. Obama for $100 an hour, right? Okay. You bring these two guys in and a couple more. Nobody connected with this, administration. And they work out a jobs program that offers something in each of 435 congressional districts. Bridge repair, dam repair, railroad beds, decaying school structures. I mean, the list just goes on and on. Road beds, interstate highway repair, secondary road repair. I mean, that $2 or $3 trillion worth of infrastructure that absolutely needs to be taken care of yesterday, according to the U.S. Society of Engineers, or American Society of Engineers, whichever one it is. They put that report out, what, a year ago? And what's been done? Nothing. Anyway, Obama draws this up, 435 congressional districts in this country. And Obama targets each one of those districts with a jobs program. And each one of those districts, let's say, oh, I don't know, 1,000 jobs in each one. That's only 435,000 jobs. So it would be much more than that when you consider the ripple effect. But just start any place, 10,000 jobs, 100,000 jobs, whatever, in each district, and show how it can be done. And then, when Congress comes back, Obama asks for prime time. He goes on television. He says, here's my jobs program. Here's how it will affect every single district in this country, every single congressional district. If you're in the 4th District in Georgia, here are the jobs that I'm suggesting. Here is the paychecks it'll generate. Here is the tax revenue it'll generate. Here are the residual businesses or the ripple effect that it will affect the restaurants and dry cleaners and all sorts of businesses in your communities. Here it is. All we need is funding. Yeah, deficit funding from the Congress. And here's how long it'll take before tax revenue generates enough money to pay it all off. And put it out there. And then demand that the Republicans say no. Make every single Republican say no to the jobs and the revenue and the improvement in his or her personal district. Put it out there, Mr. President. Then let these evil sons of bitches turn it down and watch America finally take to the streets.
You, Secretary of the Treasury, for God's sakes, man, you won the Nobel Prize. Timothy Geithner uses TurboTax. When I listen to you, things seem to make sense. Listen to him, all I hear is blah, blah, blah. Hey, Paul Krugman, where the hell are you, man? Obama breakdown. Sing it with me now when I listen to you.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Just seems to me that that's a very simple solution. Show the jobs plan in each of 435 congressional districts and then dare the Republicans to vote against it. But of course, Barack Obama won't do that because Barack Obama, first of all, is he's not a progressive, he's not a Democrat, he's not a leader. He is what he is. He is he's there to maintain the status quo, the casino capitalism, and that's, by God, what he is going to do. Again, tonight's program, all this week, is brought to you by Farm Aid 2011. The entire week is underwritten by them. It's 26 years ago that Willie Nelson and the Farm Aid people started working to keep family farmers on their land. This year, it's this Saturday, August 13th, Kansas City, Kansas. Go to farmaid.org, take a look. There, if you want to make a donation, you can. There also is a site there where you can send an email to, or you can sign a petition or send an email to your senator asking him or her to get off their asses and do something for small family farms and small family ranches instead of corporate agribusinesses as they always do. Farm Aid 2011. Go to their website, okay? Farmaid.org. In Houston on Saturday, this comes under the heading of Christian priorities, okay? In Houston, Texas on Saturday, Governor Rick Perry led 30,000 people in prayer at a rally led by a collection of hypocrites, con artists, and haters. Very seldom assembled under one roof, but there they were. I'm not talking about these poor hapless creatures out in the audience who are swaying back and forth and raising their hands up to the rafters. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the evil bastards who are up there doing the speaking. I'll get to them in a minute. But anyway, 30,000 people decided to turn out to, at this prayer rally and talk to a cloud being and wail and moan and talk in tongues and jibber-jabber and expect that because they are raising their voices to some unseen being someplace floating around, that means something other than the fact that the people who do it are truly clinically mad. But But there they were. Meanwhile, the next day, down the street, 100,000 people turned out for a back-to-school event to receive free school supplies, free food, and free immunizations. Now, how many of those 30,000 were at Rick Perry's masturbatory prayer ritual? How many of those 30,000 went down the street to help the 100,000 who were there looking for help? Huh? You think some of them did? Maybe? As you treat these, the least of my children, so you treat me. Hypocritical bastards. Oh, my God. Oprah Winfrey is a harlot, according to one of the evangelical thugs who was there. Let me give you a list. Let me tell you who was there. Mike Bickle. He was one of the Christians. He said Oprah Winfrey is a sign of the apocalypse. He called Oprah, in his God TV program, quote, a forerunner to the harlot movement, end quote. Bickle also warned the traditional marriage will be defiled as the gay marriage agenda, which is rooted in the depths of hell, progresses. One of Rick Perry's lovers. Another one, Dr. Cindy Jacobs. She said blackbirds are dying in Arkansas because of gay soldiers. You're goddamn right they are. She recorded a video declaring a connection between the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the sudden deaths of blackbirds in Beebe, Arkansas. That's a divine punishment, amen? She also called girl-on-girl kissing a plague on society and asked divine forgiveness for the violation of a woman's, her words, natural use. Jesus Christ.
All natural use of our lady parts aside, how does the lady connect dead birds in Arkansas with gay marriage in New York? I'm just curious.
No. Gay soldiers.
Gay soldiers.
Right.
Gay soldiers, gay marriage. What, in New York? Why would God kill Arkansas birds? As opposed to birds in New York.
Because he's a psychopath. Why did he order Jacob to cross the River Jordan and kill all the Canaanites? Because he's crazy.
Okay, so.
That's all.
Gays in the military in one area kill the birds somewhere else.
Exactly. That's what a psychopathic, totally deranged God does. If you don't see the connection, Kathy, that's because you're not saved. John Benefiel, who was also in support of this half-witted Rick Perry, he called the Statue of Liberty a demonic idol in various sermons. He said that it's a demonic idol. He also expressed a belief that homosexuality is a plot contrived by the Illuminati to limit the world population. Jesus God. Oh, John Hagee was there. Oh my God, isn't he a piece of work? All big part of him. What an enormous lard ass this guy is. There's somebody who eats well, huh? Or eats a lot, anyway. Anyway, Hagee said, as you know, Hurricane Katrina was divine retribution for the sin of New Orleans because, you know, they do music down there and they mix the races and they have homosexuality. And Hagee also said that the Holocaust was the fault of the Jews and Hitler acted as a hunter, God's hunter, corralling the Jews into Israel. These are Rick Perry's good buddies. These are the boys and girls with whom Rick Perry decided to have this huge circle jerk down there in Texas. Dwight McKissick denounced comparisons between the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement because the gay rights movement is a satanic anointment. inspired by the Antichrist that comes from the pit of hell. McKissick also said that God uses natural disasters to punish, pointing to Hurricane Katrina because New Orleans flaunts sin. Oh, come on, you silly ass. That's Hagee's routine. Get your own, McKissick. David Barton, another one of Rick Perry's butt buddies, influential pastor. He's made a name for himself by distorting biblical text to support his claim that Jesus H. Christ opposed the minimum wage and the capital gains tax. You didn't know that, truth seeker? You Bible-believing freak, you didn't know that Jesus opposed the capital gains tax? Why? How could that be? You call yourself a Christian and you don't know that? Pastor David Barton has also argued that public school students are getting homosexual indoctrination. Another one of Rick Perry's butt buddies who supported the day of prayer down there in Texas on Saturday. And then you have Jim Garlow. Oh, Jim Garlow. He said during this year's Faith and Freedom Conference that, he compared orphans of the September 11th attacks to children raised in same-sex households. Now, there's a lovely man, isn't there? Garlow is also known for his controversial allegation that African Americans have saved the country from the enslavement of gay marriage. Okay. Another one of Rick Perry's butt buddies. And then you have the director of a Christian paramilitary group. His name is Jay Swallow. I kid you not, that's his name. He is the director of SWAT, a Christian military training camp organized for the purpose of dealing with the occult and territorial enemy strongholds in America. Participants in his training session sign a liability waiver before becoming warriors, amen, against occult and territorial enemy strongholds in America. Participants are also trained how to pray for casinos on Native American land, amen. Bring the casinos. Willie Wooten published a book about the curse of the African-American people. He wrote that their tolerance of immorality in the Democratic Party begets curses of adultery, incest, children from incestuous union, children born out of wedlock, destroyed virginity, bestiality, homosexuality, lesbianism, amen. These are all the close personal friends of Rick Perry. Can you imagine being in that prayer service on Saturday? Was probably like being in the second ring of hell.
Watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. You know, I don't think I can, as a matter of fact, I know I can't watch any more of these pieces on network television. They usually are placed inside a newscast, usually the second or third to the last story, about kids who are waiting for their moms or dads to come back from the most recent deployment to a war zone, in most cases Afghanistan, where they've been deployed by corporate America. And or those pieces where a little kid, you know, shows up for school and the surprise of the day is daddy or mommy who's been gone for months walks into the classroom, and the kid almost, you know, has the 8-year-old equivalent of a stroke. I don't know why these television stations put those pieces out there. And then you have the pieces where little kids have to deal with the fact that their father was killed trying to make Afghanistan safe for corporate America. I can't watch him anymore. I have to turn him off. I used to be able to watch him, and invariably I'd sit there and get very teary-eyed, get very choked up, and I'd come downstairs and Kathy and say, "Oh my God, what are you crying about?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, another kid waiting for mom or dad to come home from a war zone story." Kathy'd say, "Why in the hell do you watch those?" Every time I see one of those, I want to, I know it wouldn't make a least bit of difference, but I want to call the local, if it's a local story, the local television story, if it's a network story, the network, and just say, "How dare you keep doing this? How dare you keep doing this? Why aren't you advocating that American troops who are deployed to 80 or 90 countries around the world on hundreds of military bases, why don't you start working to bring them home and stop with this crapola where you show these poor, innocent children and you use them, you dirty bastards, you use these little children to try to drum up more war fever, you know? Oh yeah, well let's go kill all the fill in the blank so we can bring the troops home. But first we have to kill all the fill in the blank before we can bring the troops home." What brought this up was the death over the weekend of 30 American special forces in Afghanistan. Their helicopter shot out of the sky by either an LPG, or a Stinger missile. Nobody is sure yet. I'm surprised that the U.S. military didn't declare it a mechanical failure. But the deaths of 30 soldiers who either were or were not on a mission, who either were or were not a part of a SEAL team this or SEAL team that, whoever were or were not operating inside Afghanistan or heading to Pakistan. I realize what the cover stories are, but you don't know. You have no idea. So here we have 30 young men who have been trained specifically to be killers for America. That's all. SEAL team or Army Rangers are not trained to take prisoners. They are trained to kill. And they are trained to kill without any thought whatsoever. Get the target, take the target out, end of story. And I guess one could make an argument. There was a time I probably would make the argument where such hit squads were absolutely necessary for the furtherance of the goals and aims of the wonderful social democracy that is the United States. But Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Iraq are not places where that's any where there's any truth to that at all. So guys who are trained to kill swiftly, to kill quietly, and to leave are still being deployed by corporate capitalist America for the betterment of the utterly wealthy, for the betterment of that upper one half of 1%. Tell me how the use of SEAL team members or Army Rangers in some godforsaken part of Afghanistan is a direct benefit to a family in, oh, I don't know, pick someplace, Ames, Iowa. There is no direct benefit. These men are being sacrificed like non-combatant people, non-military people are being sacrificed here on the altar of this filthy, degenerate, casino, predatory capitalism. And every time I see another story of more American soldiers killed, more young, relatively speaking, if not absolutely young, Americans who are blown to pieces or shot down, I just it sickens me to the same degree that it sickens me when I see the pictures of screaming children in a village in Afghanistan who have just watched their parents be turned into red mist by a Predator missile fired from a drone aircraft operated by some 26-year-old in Texas. I mean, when is this going to stop? Barack Obama is a warmonger. He is of the same category of Dick Cheney, George W. Bush. He is a warmonger. And whether he knows it or not, he is, and I'm sure he does know it, he is doing absolutely what the capitalist dogs who own him are ordering him to do. And we still have people who insist that Barack Obama is a liberal or progressive, and any argument to the contrary is an argument that comes from a moron or someone who doesn't understand the intricacies of playing political chess. Is Farm Aid 2011. It is that time again, Saturday, August 13th, this Saturday in Kansas City, Kansas. Farm Aid since 1985, Willie Nelson and Farm Aid have worked to keep family farmers on their land. You know what Farm Aid's about. If you have any doubts, go to farmaid.org and take a look around the website. And on Saturday, the 13th, if you can't attend Farm Aid concert, you can watch it live at farmaid.org. Just log on and enjoy. The program is also underwritten by BioWillie and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. Willie Nelson started BioWillie, a biodiesel company. And as you know, it's a renewable and sustainable fuel which reduces our dependence on foreign oil. And this does not use or replace food production. Biodiesel is, for the most part, waste products. Ask your fuel supplier when BioWillie will be available in your area. There's an article I really want you to read. I read it. Jesse Richard at TVNewsLies.org wrote it. And it's up at their website, TVNewsLies.org. And the headline is, "Our troops do not protect our freedom, and we should stop thanking them for doing so." And I wish I could do this whole thing on the air, but I have something planned for the third hour about the uselessness of Barack Obama as president of the United States. But I want you to read what Jesse Richard wrote anyway. So if you will go to TVNewsLies.org and read this piece that Jesse Richard, who is the editor there, or the founder, I should say, of TVNewsLies.org. Just read this. It's my understanding that that website has been under heavy attack today because of what Jesse Richard has written. And I don't think you'll disagree when you read it. The attack always comes from the crazy bastards in this country who can no more handle the truth than you can handle hot boiling acid. So go to TVNewsLies.org and read what Jesse Richard wrote. Please. I didn't mean that to sound like an order. Prairie 2 says, Asian markets are now open and off 5 to 8%. Dear God, 5 to 8% with Korea doing the worst so far. Hold on to your ass, really, folks. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. We've been talking about this for a year or two, about the fact that capitalism eventually has to devour itself. Capitalism can only go so far. It's based on exploitation. Now, granted, there are still places on Earth human populations on Earth that are very exploitable by capitalism. I'm sure. I'm just not sure where they are. A lot of countries now have put up firewalls against this form of this sick economic system. So there are countries on Earth that capitalism cannot penetrate, at least not the kind that you and I are being burned alive with. But it has reached that point. If it hasn't, I don't know what signs and portents are necessary to let people know that casino capitalism or predatory capitalism, the kind that is practiced in this country with furious disregard for anything other than profit and greed, it is reaching the point where it's no longer sustainable. And the problem with its death is that it's going to kill an awful lot of people and companies and ideas and countries and currencies as it commits suicide. Now, I don't know, I don't know how to, I'm not a Paul Revere, let me put it that way. I'm not riding through the villages warning the British that, God, I just can't get what Sarah Palin said about that out of my mind. Oh, my God. We have several Paul Reveres who contribute to this program. But, you know, again, as Dylan said, you don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing. And I think what we're seeing is the beginning of the beginning of something profound and global that is happening. Now, you may disagree. You may say, no, Malloy, this is a cyclical thing like this hot weather. It's just cyclical. It comes, it goes. Really? Is that all it is? Well, thank goodness for that, huh? Regarding the RPG, what did I call it, LPG? Dear God. Regarding the RPG used to bring down the Chinook helicopter in Afghanistan that took the lives of 30 Americans and 8 Afghans, Bruce writes, they probably wouldn't have admitted to the shoot down except that there were Afghan soldiers on board. RPGs are extremely ineffective against helicopters, and the Soviets dominated the countryside until we started handing out Stinger missiles. Firing an RPG up toward a helicopter means the fireball from the launch lands in your lap. Stinger missiles are launched horizontally and climb on the target from their own guidance system. While they were George Jetson technology in the 1980s, anybody should be able to build them now, and it's only a matter of time before they become widely available. Reporters are saying that the pilots are now hugging the ground, which is the opposite of what you would do in response to an RPG. So apparently, they are afraid a Stinger-like missile has been introduced to the battlefield in Afghanistan. Not good news for Americans who have volunteered to, in their minds, serve their country and who are, in fact, serving corporate America. And this is from Justine in Maryland. Mike, why is Standard & Poor's still in business and allowed to operate? Let's not forget how quickly Acorn was taken down after 40 years of service to this country. S&P was among the ones who fraudulently and knowingly rated toxic mortgage-backed securities as AAA, when in fact, as that company was completely aware, these securities were completely worthless. S&P was a huge contributor to the 2008 crash of the economy, and they're still calling the shots. WTF? Of course, these are rhetorical questions that will remain unanswered, let alone unasked, while BS propaganda continues to blanket our airwaves. And at least one Obama apologist is now defending the administration by saying it can't use the Justice Department to go after those who stole from us. This so-called liberal commentator said today that the Obama administration is like the police who come to your house after you've been robbed, catalog what has been stolen, and tell you, sorry, but there's not much we can do. The commentator repeated that analogy, so I don't think it was simply an off-the-cuff statement. That's even more offensive than the generic corporate media promulgating the lies of the teabaggers and Republicans, although in one respect the apologists are correct. Obama, his staff, and a growing number of Democrats are choosing to be powerless and forcing the consequences of their failure and inaction on the rest of us. Whether it's the economy, torture, health care, bogus wars, science and the environment, civil liberties, education, and so on, it doesn't matter. And it's not can't, it's won't. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but isn't Viagra covered for treatment of impotence and all of the health insurance plans available to federal politicians, including the president? Justine in Maryland.
Filtered only with Mike Malone.
Twenty-one past the hour. Got this from Robert in North Carolina. I'm going to read to you a list of, it's very quick, 13 developed nations with a triple A rating. The United States now has a double A plus. But I'm going to read you a list of 13 countries, well, 12 countries and one independent political entity, and see if you can guess what a common thread among these 13 that have the kind of credit rating that the United States had up until last week. Here are the countries: Switzerland, Hong Kong, Sweden, Germany, Canada, Denmark, Britain, the Netherlands, Finland, Norway, Austria, France, and Australia. Now, those 13 are all rated AAA by Standard & Poor's Sovereign and also considered stable. The United States is now AA plus negative. That's the outlook. The rating and then the outlook. The outlook for the United States, according to S&P, is negative. But what do those 13 countries have as a common thread? If you said socialism to greater or lesser degrees, depending on the country, you're absolutely right. As Robert in Northern California writes, note that every one of the 13 developed nations with the AAA rating has policies that are substantially more socialist than those of the United States, most of them dramatically so. So the answer to all this craziness? Socialism. And to stop fighting wars that only benefit a few rich jerks. Robert in Northern California. It's just astonishing. I cannot get my mind around it. We've had social democracy a bit of it, a taste of it in this country. And so much of it was guaranteed to save the stinking life of predatory capitalism. The social democracy was put in place. I mean, that's what FDR did. He saved predatory capitalism from its own hangman's noose. And how did these sons of bitches show their gratitude? They spent the ensuing 80 years devouring, eating, ripping to pieces, tearing, sucking up, destroying, violating the very system that allowed them to do this to begin with. When this house of cards finally does collapse, you know, I hope all of us get through somehow. I really do. I mean, most of us have family. We have friends. We have our own little social structures. We have an existence that we've built. Whether we're single, married, gay, straight, Jew, Gentile, doesn't make any difference. We have these little structures that we've put together that mean something to us. For some of us, it's a one-room apartment. For other people, it's a house that you know, you saved up some money, you bought or made a down payment on. I hope we all survive this. But I hope that when it comes time to rebuild, and I know Bruce is right now writing a rebuttal to this. Come on, Malloy, quit being so apocalyptic. Come on, Bruce, please. But when we do survive this, when this predatory, disgusting system finally collapses, is finally stomped into the ground, when we finally cut its throat, let's hope that the system that we build to take its place is one that's rational, reasonable, based on economics rather than greed, based on trust rather than suspicion, based on an equal chance for people rather than the deck stacked against you from the moment you suck in your first breath. It's doable. It's so doable. And further, if you one other thing I want to recommend to you, I'd love to quote from it, but it's in the New Yorker magazine, this issue. It's about the philosopher Lucretius, about 2,000 years ago, a poem that he wrote. And that's all I can tell you without, you know, really getting into the article, which I'd love to do. I just don't know if a radio talk radio format is the right place to do it. But it's an astonishing article. I use that word a lot, don't I? It's an incredible article. It will open your eyes. It did mine. You know, just when you think you know, oh, maybe 75-80% of everything that you need to know, you come across an article like the one in the New Yorker. I'll get the title for it. And did we post that at our website? We didn't. We need to post that so people can just click on the link. And if you don't do anything else, I'd like you to read that. We'll be right back.
It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. You can try the TVNewsLies.org website again now. Reg said it crashed there for a while because so many people tried to get onto it. TVNewsLies.org and read what Jesse Richard wrote. You really need to do it. Okay, TVNewsLies.org. Jesse Richards, who is the founder of that website. London is burning. I guess you're aware of that. For the fifth day in a row, civil unrest. Hundreds of young people looting shops, setting businesses on fire, clashing with police. And this is a city that is supposed to host the Summer Olympics in less than a year. According to the Washington Post, the violence has now spread to Britain's second largest city, Birmingham. Hundreds of youths rioted, attacked, and looted shops. Prime Minister David Cameron cut short a vacation, was returned to London to chair an emergency cabinet meeting to handle the mounting crisis. The Metropolitan Police, you know, Scotland Yard, called in reinforcements from law enforcement forces outside London. The unrest, if that's what you want to call it, is spreading in part via BlackBerry text messages, as well as postings on Twitter and other social networking sites. The troubles are taking root mostly in the powder keg of poorer neighborhoods, according to the Washington Post, and away from the iconic central heart of London, popular with foreign vacationers. The violence first erupted Saturday night in Tottenham, a gritty North London neighborhood, the Post says, after the fatal shooting of a black resident by police investigating gun crimes. It's not a black thing anymore, truth seekers, if you look at some of the video. London Mayor Ken Livingstone suggested that the Tottenham riot was an unleashing of pent-up resentment over the weak economy, high unemployment, and the deep budget cuts that are decreasing government funding for poorer communities and grassroots charities. Livingstone blamed a sense that young Britons are facing, quote, the bleakest future, end quote. He told the BBC, quote, this is the first generation since the Great Depression that have doubts about their future, end quote. Watch out. Britain's government denounced the spreading riots as an extraordinary spree of opportunistic criminality. Mm. Well, yeah, what are they going to call it? Do you think the ruling class is going to say, yes, this is expected because of what we have done and what we continue to do to workers here in the UK, to the middle class here in the UK? When do you suppose it's going to come here? You know, it is now taking root in a predominantly white country, a Caucasian country, Britain. To be more specific, England. Up to this point, it's been countries whose dominant populations are non-white, whether it is Libya or Tunisia or Syria or wherever. Greece, they're not considered white, are they? I know my family from Italy wasn't considered white. So now it has struck a Caucasian country. From Kauai John in Hawaii, he writes, Mike, I venture that those of us who hold Bush and the Republicans responsible for our current economic state had enough time to understand that today's drop in the Dow Jones of over 600 points was inevitable. And so my 401k is all cash. Those who think Obama is at fault kept their money in stock. And they do not understand that the reason their 401k is disappearing is because of policies promoted by the Republican Party. They believed in the right-wing talking heads, and they left their money on the table. When they cry that the game is rigged, here's my response. Of course it's rigged, you ignorant idiot. But even with the evidence I've given you for years, you still somehow believe that more tax cuts will create more revenue. How stupid are you? This crash has been advertised for over 2 years, but you were watching Fox News. You didn't listen to me. You laughed at me. While I have no joy in seeing you brought down, I know it is what you deserve for your belief that you are somehow better than everyone else. If I ever thought you might help me, even a 1 in 4 chance, I'd help you. But if I needed help, your leaders, religious and political, would offer you any number of excuses to not follow your true conscience. And you, thinking you're better than me, will turn your back on me. Knowing this, I'll tell you how sorry I am you lost, but I'm not in any position to help you out since I have to live in the world you created. For those who don't understand today's world, let me make it simple for you. I got mine, screw you. Kawai John. All right, TVNewsLies.org is under attack again. Please ask your listeners to try again later. We're leaving the article on as the lead article. All right. Just try later. Oh, my God. I've got in front of me here a reproduction of the cover of this week's Newsweek with the Queen of Rage on the cover. Jesus, what a picture. What a demonic. I mean, you know, Sarah Palin had protection placed around her by an African evangelical exorcist before she ran for, I guess, was she governor then? Maybe it's before she ran for governor. But you remember that little piece of video where the African evangelical preacher from where? Mali? Was it Mali? Is exhorting protection from, you know, the good angels or something against the bad angels or something. I don't know. You remember that piece of video. Well, Michelle Bachmann apparently did not get that protection. This woman is demonically possessed. And it doesn't take this picture on Newsweek to understand that. Now, by demonically possessed, I'm speaking metaphorically. Okay, I don't believe in that garbage any more than I believe in tooth fairies. But, okay, I don't believe in that garbage. I do believe in tooth fairies. But there she is. With it, and it's a photograph of her. I mean, I don't know. What is Newsweek supposed to do? Take a look at it and say, oh, whoops, wait a minute. This one has you too wide-eyed. You look like you're possessed. Conservative websites are peeing their pants over the cover, saying it made Bachmann look crazy. No, I'm sorry, you half-witted morons. This picture doesn't make her look crazy. She's crazier than a goddamn outhouse rat. What are you talking about? Oh, Lord have mercy. Go to Newsweek.com and take a look at this. Oh, and I guess the National Organization for Women is making the spurious claim that if she were a he, this sort of picture would not be run. I don't quite get that. You know, once again, we have what is a civil rights organization, National Organization for Women, reaching across, reaching out to someone who would chop their goddamn arm off at the elbow. National Organization for Women, you don't have to reach out to this psychopath. Why are you doing that? Are you trying to do a Barack Obama, reaching out to people like Mitch McConnell or Eric Cantor or some of these other crazy people? What is it with liberal or civil rights, progressive organizations in this country that they can't step outside their assigned role and admit that Michelle Bachmann is a goddamn lunatic? And if ever elected president, one of the first things she would do by executive fiat would condemn everybody in the National Organization for Women into prison. So stop defending these people. All you left-wing lunatics, stop defending these people. They are destroying the goddamn country. Fair play? You want to play fair with these people? Are you out? Of course you are. Out of your minds.
I don't need security. I've got a Colt 45 in here with me. I'll scare off intruders in my fatigues, black jackets, and army boots. My neck is red, my collar blue. I like it that way. I don't hear liberals talking to me. I don't.
Flying monkey free zone.
10 before the hour. I didn't mean to disrespect the protesters in Israel. you may or may not know that there have been demonstrations, massive demonstrations for social justice in Israel over the past several days. Yesterday, 300,000 people, about 4%, I believe it was 4% of that nation's population, took to the streets. If we could get 4% of Americans into the streets, what would it be? 12 million? There's 330 million of us. If we could get 4%, 12 million people into the streets. Anyway, a day after that march for social justice, the Netanyahu government is pledging change. Israel's finance minister says the government will take swift action to reduce the soaring cost of living, looking to ease tensions a day after this massive demonstration over housing costs, a growing wealth disparity. It's not just here. The protests began 3 weeks ago when young Israelis pitched tents on a Tel Aviv boulevard complaining of housing costs. So once again, conservative government is under direct assault. 300,000 people gathered Saturday night in Tel Aviv, 20,000 in Jerusalem, 3,000 in Kiryat Shemona, 5,000 in Modi'in, and it goes on and on. So, how soon before it happens here? Now, there is an action planned for the first week in October in Washington. I hope you're going to be there. I hope you can be there. I realize that it's difficult to travel. It takes money to travel, at least gas money, bus money. October 6th, during that whole week, that first week to 10 days, the plan is to bring as many people to Washington, D.C. as possible and stay there. We've got to do something. We have to. I don't know what it's going to take to make this president or any president realize that we are no longer going to be willing participants in our own destruction. The population of this country has been asleep now for about 40 years, certainly for the past 30. Wages have stagnated over that period of time. Our industrial base has been cannibalized and sent someplace else. The predatory capitalists are just ripping us to pieces. They're taking everything they can get their hands on. And we're just sitting here. We're just allowing it to happen. We keep watching the numbers. Watch what happens to the stock exchange in the New York tomorrow. I have a gut feeling it's going to go down again deeply. But so what? I mean, for the people who have money, who bought into the filthy, horrid lies of these capitalist pigs who tried to talk people into 401ks and were successful as a replacement for retirement packages. That's the way it used to be. These predatory capitalists, under pressure from unions, said, okay, we will work your goddamn souls out of you for 40 years, and okay, then you'll get a pension, for God's sake. But that stopped. When did that stop? In the 70s? 80s? No more pensions. Now you get a 401k. Oh, wow. What's a 401k? Well, it's a mutual funds. Well, it's you're investing in stocks. You're investing in the future of America. Oh, really? Is that what I'm doing? Then America has no future because my stock portfolio, my 401k, is now empty. So you're telling me, oh, that's what you're... Okay. What a con job. What a goddamn con job. So, once again, what's it going to take? The Israelis have hit their tipping point. The Brits apparently have hit theirs. Certainly Northern Africa and vast areas of the Middle East have hit theirs. What's it going to take? Huh? Mexico has become a narco state, a completely failed state, because of NAFTA policies. What's it going to take? I ask that question now out of curiosity rather than as a challenge. Just curiosity. What's it going to take? How far can the American middle class be pushed into a point of a vanishing point? How much can the working class take where it concerns not being able to work before we finally say, enough of this goddamn craziness? And it can be solved very simply. We don't have to suffer economic death or social death. We don't have to. We don't have to. All right, coming up next hour, I want you to hear this. If you don't want to hear it, then switch stations. What happened to Obama? Drew Weston, professor of psychology over here at Emory University in Atlanta, had this as an op-ed piece in Sunday's New York Times. And I'm going to share it with you. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Hey, what a day, what a day. This hour is sponsored, as the previous two were all this week. As you know, if you're a regular listener to this program, program is underwritten by Farm Aid Live and Biodiesel. Farm Aid 2011, as I mentioned before, since 1985, Willie Nelson and Farm Aid have worked very hard to keep family farmers on their land. They are this country's best resource for decent food, decent health, and a strong economy. The concert this year is this coming Saturday, August 13th, in Kansas City, Kansas. And if you go to their website, farmaid.org, there's a form there for you to fill out. Tell your senators it's time to support family farmers and ranchers. Because for so long, the corporate giants, the factory food providers, which really isn't food, it's something else, but they have been the ones on the receiving end of attention from the U.S. Congress. It's time to let the Congress know that there are family farmers out here, there are family ranchers, and to respond to the needs of those people for a change, you think? Also, BioWilly and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance are underwriting the program. Willie Nelson started BioWilly, a company that mitigates the impact of greenhouse gases. Biodiesel is a renewable and sustainable fuel which reduces the dependence of this country on foreign oil. It does not take food away from people. This is not ethanol. It promotes community development. And a good idea, ask your fuel supplier when BioWilly will be available in your area. It's made in America, and it stays in America. All right, I think it's time for a rather long Uncle Mike Story Corner. I really do. Gather around, kiddies, on this warm August night. Well, Uncle Mike tells you the story of President Barack Obama. The title of tonight's story is What Happened to Obama? And it's written by Drew Weston. It was a blustery day in Washington on January 20th, 2009, as it often seems to be on the day of a presidential inauguration. As I stood with my 8-year-old daughter watching the president deliver his inaugural address, I had a feeling of unease. It wasn't just that the man who could be so eloquent had seemingly chosen not to be on this auspicious occasion, although that turned out to be a troubling harbinger of things to come. It was that there was a story the American people were waiting to hear and needed to hear, but he didn't tell it. And in the ensuing months, he continued not to tell it, no matter how outrageous the slings and arrows his opponents threw at him. The stories our leaders tell us matter, probably almost as much as the stories our parents tell us as children, because they orient us to what is, what could be, and what should be, to the worldviews they hold and to the values they hold sacred. Our brains evolve to expect stories with a particular structure, with protagonists and villains, a hill to be climbed or a battle to be fought. Our species existed for more than 100,000 years before the earliest signs of literacy, and another 5,000 years would pass before the majority of humans would know how to read and write. Stories, you see, were the primary way our ancestors transmitted knowledge and values. Today, we seek movies, novels, and so-called news stories that put the events of the day in a form that our brains evolved to find compelling and memorable. Children crave bedtime stories. The holy books of the three great monotheistic religions are written in parables. And as research and cognitive science has shown, lawyers with whose closing arguments tell a story win jury trials against their legal adversaries who just lay out the facts of the case. When Barack Obama rose to the lectern on Inauguration Day, the nation was in tatters. Americans were scared and angry. The economy was spinning in reverse. 750,000 people lost their jobs that month. Many had lost their homes, and with them the only nest eggs they had. Even the usually impervious upper middle class had seen a decade of stagnant or declining investment, with the stock market dropping in value and no end in sight. Hope was as scarce as credit. In that context, Americans needed their president to tell them a story that made sense of what they had just been through, what caused it, and how it was going to end. They needed to hear that he understood what they were feeling, that he would track down those responsible for their pain and suffering, and that he would restore order and safety. What they were waiting for, in broad strokes, was a story something like this. I know you're scared and angry. Many of you have lost your jobs, your homes, your hope. This was a disaster. But it was not a natural disaster. It was made by Wall Street gamblers who speculated with your lives and futures. It was made by conservative extremists who told us that if we just eliminated regulations and rewarded greed and recklessness, it would all work out. But it didn't work out. And it didn't work out 80 years ago when the same people sold our grandparents the same bill of goods with the same results. But we learned something from our grandparents about how to fix it. And we will draw on their wisdom. We will restore business confidence the old-fashioned way, by putting money back in the pockets of working Americans, by putting them back to work, and by restoring integrity to our financial markets and demanding it of those who want to run them. I can't promise that we won't make mistakes along the way, but I can promise you that they will be honest mistakes, and that your government has your back again. A story isn't a policy. But that simple narrative and the policies that would naturally have flowed from it would have inoculated against much of what was to come in the intervening 2.5 years of failed government, idled factories, and idled hands. That story would have made clear that the president understood that the American people had given Democrats the presidency and majorities in both houses of Congress to fix the mess the Republicans and Wall Street had made of the country. And this would not be a power-sharing arrangement. It would have made clear that the problem wasn't tax and spend liberalism or the deficit, a deficit, by the way, that didn't exist until George W. Bush gave nearly $2 trillion in tax breaks, largely to the wealthiest Americans, and squandered another trillion into wars. And perhaps most important, it would have offered a clear, compelling alternative to the dominative narrative of the right, that our problem is not due to spending on things like the pensions of firefighters, but to the fact that those who can afford to buy influence are rewriting the rules so they can cut themselves progressively larger slices of the American pie while paying less of their fair share for it. But there was no story, and there has been none since. In similar circumstances, Franklin D. Roosevelt offered Americans a promise to use the power of his office to make their lives better and to keep trying until he got it right. Beginning in his first inaugural address and in the fireside chats that followed, he explained how the crash had happened, and he minced no words about those who had caused it. He promised to do something no president had done before, to use the resources of the United States to put Americans directly to work, building the infrastructure we still rely on today. He swore to keep the people who had caused the crisis out of the halls of power, and he made good on that promise. In a 1936 speech at Madison Square Garden, he thundered, "Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred." More in a moment.
Time I turn on the TV,
there's hope.
Somebody's acting crazy,
there's hope.
You let it, it'll drive you crazy,
there's hope.
But I'm taking back my power today,
there's hope.
Gas prices, they just keep on rising,
there's hope.
The government, they keep on lying. We gotta keep on surviving, keep living our truth and do the best.
They dig those styles they wear.
Where is the outrage? Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, continuing with Uncle Mike's Story Corner, written today by Drew Weston, professor of psychology at Emory University here in Atlanta. When Barack Obama stepped into the Oval Office, he stepped into a cycle of American history, best exemplified by FDR and his distant cousin Teddy. After a great technological revolution or a major economic transition, as when America changed from a nation of farmers to an urban industrial one, there's often a period of great concentration of wealth, and with it, a concentration of power in the wealthy. That's what we saw in 1928, and that's what we see today. At some point, that power is exercised so injudiciously, and the lives of so many people become so unbearable, that a period of reform ensues, and a charismatic reformer emerges to lead that renewal. In that sense, Teddy Roosevelt started the cycle of reform his cousin picked up 30 years later, as he began efforts to bust the trusts and regulate the railroads, exercise federal power over the banks and the nation's food supply, and protect America's land and wildlife, creating the modern environmental movement. Those were the shoes. That was the historic role that Americans elected Barack Obama to fill. The president is fond of referring to the arc of history, paraphrasing the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous statement that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But with his deep-seated aversion to conflict and his profound failure to understand bully pulpits, in which conciliation is always the wrong course of action because bullies perceive it as weakness and just punch harder the next time, Barack Obama has broken that arc and has likely bent it backwards for at least a generation. When Dr. King spoke of the great arc bending toward justice, he didn't mean that we should wait for it to bend. He exhorted others to put their full weight behind it, and he gave his life speaking with a voice that cut through the blistering force of water cannons and the gnashing teeth of police dogs. He preached the gospel of nonviolence, but he knew that whether a bully hid behind a club or a poll tax, the only effective response was to face the bully down and to make the bully show his true and repugnant face in public. In contrast, when faced with the greatest economic crisis, the greatest levels of economic inequality, and the greatest levels of corporate influence on politics since the Depression, Barack Obama stared into the eyes of history and chose to avert his gaze. Instead of indicting the people whose recklessness wrecked the economy, he put them in charge of it. He never explained that decision to the public, a failure in storytelling as extraordinary as the failure in judgment behind it. Had the president chosen to bend the arc of history, he would have told the public the story of the destruction wrought by the dismantling of the New Deal regulations that had protected them for more than half a century. He would have offered them a counter-narrative of how to fix the problem, other than the politics of appeasement, one that emphasized creating economic demand and consumer confidence by putting consumers back to work. He would have had to stare down those who had wrecked the economy, and he would have had to tolerate their hatred if not welcome it. But the arc of his temperament just didn't bend that far. The truly decisive move that broke the arc of history was Obama's handling of the stimulus. The public was desperate for a leader who would speak with confidence, and they were ready to follow wherever the president led. Yet instead of indicting the economic policies and principles that had just eliminated 8 million jobs, in the most damaging of the tick-like gestures of compromise that have become the hallmark of Obama's presidency, and against the advice of multiple Nobel Prize-winning economists, he backed away from his advisors who proposed big stimulus and then diluted it with tax cuts that had already been shown to be inert. The result, as predicted in advance, was a half-stimulus that half-stimulated the economy. That, in turn, led the White House to feel rightly unappreciated for having saved the country from another Great Depression, but in the unenviable position of having to argue a counterfactual that something terrible might have happened had it not half-acted. To the average American who was still staring into the abyss, the half-stimulus did nothing but prove that Ronald Reagan was right, that government is the problem. In fact, the average American had no idea what Democrats were trying to accomplish by deficit spending because no one bothered to explain it to them with the repetition and evocative imagery that our brains require to make an idea, particularly a paradoxical one, stick. Nor did anyone explain what health care reform was supposed to accomplish, or why credit card reform had led to an increase in the interest rates they were already struggling to pay. Nor did anyone explain why saving the banks was such a priority when saving the homes the banks were foreclosing didn't seem to be. All Americans knew, and all they know today, is that they're still unemployed. They're still worried about how they're going to pay their bills at the end of the month, and their kids still can't get a job. And now the Republicans are chipping away at unemployment insurance, and the president is making his usual impotent verbal exhortations about after bargaining it away. Stick around. More of Uncle Mike's Story Corner right after the break.
It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, continuing Drew Weston. Drew Weston's contribution to Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight. He's a professor of psychology at Emory University here in Atlanta. And the title of his essay, by the way, was in the Sunday New York Times, What Happened to Obama? Continuing now. What makes the deficit debate we just experienced seem so surreal is how divorced the conversation in Washington has been from conversations around the kitchen table everywhere else in America. Although I am a scientist by training, over the last several years as a messaging consultant to nonprofit groups and Democratic leaders, I've studied the ways voters think and feel, talking to them in plain language. At this point, I've interacted in person or virtually with more than 50,000 Americans on a range of issues from taxes and deficits to abortion and immigration. The average voter is far more worried about jobs than about the deficit, which few were talking about while Bush and the Republican Congress were running it up. The conventional wisdom is that Americans hate government, and if you ask the question in the abstract, people will certainly give you an earful about what government does wrong. But if you give them the choice between cutting the deficit and putting Americans back to work, it isn't even close. But it's not just jobs. Americans don't share the priorities of either party on taxes, budgets, or any of the things Congress and the president have just agreed to slash or failed to slash, like subsidies to oil companies. When it comes to tax cuts for the wealthy, Americans are united across the political spectrum, supporting a message that says, in times like these, millionaires ought to be giving to charity, not getting it. When pitted against a tough budget-cutting message straight from the mouth of its strongest advocates, swing voters vastly preferred a message that began, "The best way to reduce the deficit is to put Americans back to work." This statement is far more consistent with what many economists are saying publicly and what investors apparently believe, as evident in the nosedive the stock market is taking after the president and Congress saved the economy. So where does this leave us? Like most Americans at this point, I have no idea what Barack Obama, and by extension the party he leads, believes on virtually any issue. The president tells us he prefers a balanced approach to deficit reduction, one that weds revenue enhancements with entitlement cuts. But the law he just signed includes only the cuts. This pattern of presenting inconsistent positions with no apparent recognition of their incoherence is another hallmark of Barack Obama's storytelling. He announces in a speech on energy and climate change that we need to expand offshore oil drilling and coal production, two methods of obtaining fuels that contribute to the extreme weather Americans are now seeing. He supports a health care law that will use Medicaid to insure about 15 million more Americans, and then endorses a budget plan that, though the cuts through cuts to state budgets, will most likely decimate Medicaid and other essential programs for children, senior citizens, and people who are vulnerable by virtue of disabilities or an economy that is getting weaker by the day. He gives a major speech on immigration reform after deporting a million immigrants in 2 years, breaking up families at a pace George W. Bush could never rival in all his years as president. The real conundrum is why this president seems so compelled to take both sides of every issue, encouraging voters to project whatever they want on him and hoping they won't realize which hand is holding the rabbit. That a large section of the country views him as a socialist, while many in his own party are concluding that he does not share their values, speaks volumes, but not the volumes his advisors are selling. And that is, if you make both the right and the left angry, you must be doing something right. As a practicing psychologist with more than 25 years of experience, I will resist the temptation to diagnose at a distance. But as a scientist and strategic consultant, I will venture some hypotheses. The most charitable explanation is that Obama and his advisors have succumbed to a view of electoral success to which many Democrats succumb, that centrist voters like centrist politicians. Unfortunately, reality is more complicated. Centrist voters prefer honest politicians who help them solve their problems. A second possibility is that Obama is simply not up to the task by virtue of his lack of experience and a character defect that might not have been so debilitating at some other time in history. Those of us who were bewitched by his eloquence on the campaign trail chose to ignore some disquieting aspects of his biography, that he had accomplished very little before he ran for president, having never run a business or a state, that he had a singularly unremarkable career as a law professor, publishing nothing in 12 years at the University of Chicago other than an autobiography, and that before joining the United States Senate, he had voted present instead of yes or no 130 times, sometimes dodging difficult issues. Or perhaps, like so many politicians who come to Washington, he has already been consciously or unconsciously corrupted by a system that tests the souls, even of people of tremendous integrity, by forcing them to dial for dollars. In the case of the modern presidency, for hundreds of millions of dollars. When he wants to be, this president is a brilliant and moving speaker, but his stories virtually always lack one element, the villain who caused the problem, who's always left out, described in impersonal terms, or described in passive voice, as if the cause of others' misery has no agency and hence no culpability. Whether that reflects his aversion to conflict, an aversion to conflict with potential campaign donors that today cripples both parties' ability to govern and threatens our democracy, or both, is unclear. A final explanation is that he ran for president on two contradictory platforms, as a reformer who would clean up the system, and as a unity candidate who would transcend the lines of red and blue. He has pursued the one with which he is most comfortable, given the constraints of his character, consistently choosing the message of bipartisanship over the message of confrontation. But the arc of history does not bend toward justice through capitulation cast as compromise. It does not bend when 400 people control more of the wealth than 150 million of their fellow Americans. The arc of history does not bend when the average middle-class family has seen its income stagnate over the past 30 years, while the richest 1% has seen its income rise astronomically. The arc of history does not bend when we cut the fixed incomes of our parents and grandparents so hedge fund managers can keep their 15% tax rates. It does not bend when only one side in negotiations between workers and their bosses is allowed representation. And it does not bend when, as political scientists have shown, it is not public opinion, but the opinions of the wealthy that predict the votes of the Senate. The arc of history can bend only so far before it breaks. Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Tonight, provided by Drew Weston, a professor of psychology here in Atlanta at Emory University. And the author of The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Well, wasn't that nice? Wasn't that nice, children? Uncle Mike's Story Corner on a nice, warm Sunday evening. Oh, my goodness. Monday evening. If you didn't read that when it was in the Sunday Times yesterday, on Sunday, you should get a copy. This is something that I think should be sent to every so-called liberal, every so-called progressive, especially those in media in America. In writing this piece, even though Drew Weston is not trying to kick Obama's ass, but rather show where Obama has failed to lead, that's all. And leading in the situation Obama is in should not have been that difficult. It just should not have been. When Obama came into office, as Drew Weston points out, we elected him because we wanted somebody to clean up the mess that 8 years of the Bush crime family had produced. But Obama didn't even have the story right, didn't even have the narrative right. And I get what Drew Weston is saying on Inauguration Day. There was watching this historic moment of this young African-American president being sworn in. And then the inaugural address afterwards, it was nothing. And I think that was the first inkling that people who were awestruck by this man might have had that, uh-oh. Uh-oh, things are not what they seem. Or not what I thought they seemed. And that was the problem. Like we've talked about in this program before, people wrote on the slate anything that they wanted to write about Barack Obama. And most of it has turned out to be nothing. There's no there. And I just wish that people in media, especially talk media, would have, I don't know, the integrity to stop calling this man a progressive, stop calling him a liberal, and for God's sake, stop calling him a leader.
Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky.
Because liberal is a good word, it's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. You know, I'm doing such a long piece on on this program. I realize that you know that asks the audience to accept an awful lot, to listen to a long formal piece of writing, but I don't know how else to make sure that however large or small this audience is, that people get to get exposed to what Drew Weston wrote. You may not subscribe to the New York Times, and if you're not a subscriber, now if you go to the New York Times website, there are certain articles and pieces you cannot access. So I think what Weston said was critically important, that people understand the failure of this administration. I agree with Drew Weston. It doesn't have so much to do with Barack Obama's politics, you know, whether he's left or right or centrist or whatever. Obviously, he governs from the right, even more so than Clinton did. Clinton was a right winger, moderate right winger, and I think Obama is even further to the right than Clinton was. But what matters is the failure of leadership on the part of Barack Obama, the sort of leadership that so many Americans right now are desperately looking for. The problem is that politics, like nature, isn't particularly fond of a vacuum, and will do anything to fill that vacuum. And hence, in our political system, we have the rise of such half-wits as a Michelle Bachmann or anybody on the right, really. A Rick Perry. I mean, Jesus, God in heaven, is there any more of a creepy son of a bitch trying to slither into the political system than Rick Perry? I mean, Molly Ivins warned us about this guy a decade ago. But when you look at people like Bachmann and Rick Perry, oh my God, this Alan West out of Florida and Herman Cain, and I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. These are the people that are presenting themselves to fill the vacuum. These are the people that the political vacuum have created. So, this vacuum at the top of the food chain, where we desperately need leadership, is going to be filled by somebody. It's either going to be refilled by Barack Obama, and we'll have another 4 years of, if not stagnation, then full-blown outright criminality and depression on the part of the wealthy in this country. Globally, in fact. Because nobody is policing anything any longer. Predatory capitalism has been told, go, just go for it. Rip everything to pieces. Destroy everything. Take what you want, and to hell with the people. The 99% of the people who are desperate for just a job, much less a career or wealth building, to hell with them. And there's nobody walking the beat. There's no cop on the beat saying, hey, hold on a second. No, you're not going to continue to break into homes and rape people and abduct children. So the importance of Drew Weston's piece was, to me anyway, and I hope if you read it or you heard it, I hope you agree, is to notify people that we are operating in a vacuum. We do not have political leadership in this country, especially where we desperately need it. And that is within the party that has always led us away from catastrophe, the Democrats. Leadership in that party is as useless and ineffective as the Republicans are corrupt. So if in your discussions or in your travels, whether it's up and down the radio dial or across the country, when you hear people referring to him as a socialist, just smack them in the nose, figuratively speaking, because these are people who don't have a clue. They don't know up from down, inside from outside. When you hear people referring to him as a liberal or a progressive, you might want to take a moment and just say, a liberal in what way? Progressive how? Or if you hear people referring to him as a leader or providing leadership, ask that person, how is he leading the country? What is he doing that shows leadership? Now, why continue to chip away and harp and bitch about the President of the United States? Because he's the leader. He's the one that sets the tone. He's the one that, for example, what we talked about earlier, simply laying out an economic program for that shows how every congressional district in the United States would benefit and to what degree, and then daring these Republican cockroaches to argue against funding such a plan. But Barack Obama can't do that. He can't do what we talked about. He can't sit down and say, all right, here's what I'm proposing. Massive federal spending to get this country back to the point where we have people working, people producing revenue so that we can get the government operating again. He can't do that because he is an ineffective, well, to hell with that. He is a lousy leader. He's a terrible leader. He should not be in the position he's in. And that's a shame. It's a shame from the standpoint of history. Barack Obama's presidency, and it's a shame for you and me and the rest of us. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.